It was a cold, windy night on the night that our man entered the Lion's Mouth pub on 12th Street. He stumbled in, a coldness reaching in behind him as the door closed, trying to close its icy fingers around anyone it can reach. He walked through the bar patrons in a sort of trance, staring at a spot both far away and right in front of his face, unseeing. Those around him barely acknowledged his entrance. Those who did only commented on the cold he brought in with him by opening the door. He trudged heavily to the empty stool in the corner of the bar and pulled himself into it, rubbing his hands together for warmth. The bartender, after delivering a beer to another customer at the bar, approached the man like she would any other with her usual question.
Hey there, what can I get you?
Whiskey, please.
You got it.
The bartender retrieved one of the glasses from beneath the bar and poured the man a whiskey, eyeing her new customer's odd demeanor with a sideways glance.
Here you go. You starting a tab or cashing out?
Start a tab.
Sure thing. Got something I can hang on to for the tab? Tough day.
Something like that. How much time do you have?
I'm here till close. I've got nothing but time. Let me guess. Woman trouble?
Oh, I wish. I think I've just learned more about the universe than I ever wanted to know. And now I have to live with that knowledge, and I was never meant to know it, and... Another, please. Another! Please.
Now, the bartender was used to boisterous, rude, cheap, aggressive, violent customers, so she wasn't immediately inclined to throw the man out or cut him off on account of his outburst. Instead, the man's sudden change of mood and tone, while unnerving, fascinated her. She had heard crazy people tell her all sorts of conspiracy theories and testimonies of all sorts of paranormal and supernatural experiences, and while she didn't believe any of them, they made for a good story on a boring day. So, as usual, rather than leave the crazy customer to their own devices, she began delicately prying for more information.
Do you want to tell me about it? I mean, at least then you wouldn't be the only one in the world who suffers from what you know, right? And I can't say I'm not curious.
No. No, I could never burden another person with what I've uncovered. The most merciful thing in the universe, I think, is the mind's inability to ever fully understand itself. You and I, we are meant to live in blissful ignorance of the dark mysteries surrounding us.
Now, this was an interesting twist for our bartender. Usually, when a customer claimed they'd learned a dangerous secret, or they'd been abducted by aliens or something, they couldn't wait to tell her about it. It was a normality she had grown used to throughout her years as the equivalent of a therapist with booze. But here was a man who seemingly didn't want her to know of his findings, which, of course, only made his story all the more intriguing. She pressed on, cutting into the man's words.
But we're not meant to be blissfully ignorant, not really. Scientists are discovering new things about our world every day. Ignorance isn't exactly something the human race embraces happily. We're constantly pushing to learn more, right?
Yes, yes. Science moves us forward, but it hasn't harmed us all too much. Yet. But if we keep pushing, one day we're gonna push too far and we'll discover the most horrifying truths. Man isn't equipped to handle and understand these truths. We learn them, either go mad or deny it to the point of a new dark age.
The bartender was silent for a moment, considering her next move to keep this man talking until he spilled his story out for her.
Have you ever heard the quote, "There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy"? It's from Hamlet. Shakespeare wrote that, ages ago. And since then, we've all known whether we like it or not.
Can I get a scotch?
Here you go. We've all known, whether we like it or not, that there are always things we don't and won't know. There's so many different religions in this world because we all believe different things. So knowing all that, do you still think we'd respond so terribly to a new revelation about our universe?
True. Theosophists and other groups have made guesses on the cyclical nature of life and how each being and action causes temporary effects throughout the universe. And yes, holding a religious belief in the intensity of the universe makes it easier to swallow than if a scientist tried to shove it down your throat.
The man didn't speak again for a long moment as he toyed with his drink and sipped from it, waiting so long that the bartender almost gave up hope of hearing his story. When the man spoke, almost too softly for the bartender to hear.
They didn't reveal this.
Okay. So who did?
It was an accident. I never meant to find it. It never... If I could go back.
So, it was you.
It was an accident! It just flashed out at me as I pieced a puzzle of knowledge together. Just a newspaper item and a professor's old notes, totally harmless when separate, right? These were never meant to be found and put together. I can't tell you. I can't knowingly let anyone else feel this. This.
I'm volunteering. Tell me. You'll feel better having told someone.
Just know. Once you hear this information, there is no going back to the way you saw your universe before you knew it. Are you okay with that? Do you understand the gravity of that reality?
Yes, I do. So, start from the beginning.
I feel sure that my granduncle would be rolling in his grave if I knew I was knowingly let another living soul in on this horrific truth. That's how this all began. With his death. The winter of 1926 into 1927, my granduncle, Professor George Gommel Angel, passed away suddenly. There was never a clear cause given. He was well known in the community, so when it came out that his cause of death was uncertain, everyone was enthralled. Some witnesses came forward with information on the events leading up to the moment of his death. Apparently, as he was on his way home through a shortcut, he dropped suddenly to the ground after a young sailor bumped into him along the walkway.
Oh, pardon me.
I saw him leaving the waterfront and heading up the hillside in a shortcut. I believe he was coming from the Newport boat.
I was worried when he walked by. I thought he wouldn't be able to make the trek uphill at his age, but he seemed determined.
He was doing fine until moments after he bumped into that strange young sailor. The sailor seemed to intentionally knock into him, and then bam! The professor collapsed.
Cause of death is not an obvious one in this case, I'm afraid. There's no outward wounds or signs of a struggle, and he had no drugs or poison in his bloodstream, or signs of asphyxiation. The only conclusion we can reach with any confidence is that, at his old age, his heart gave out with the strain of climbing the hillside.
After I got the news, I went to collect all of the professor's files and belongings as I was the heir and the executor of his will. He had no children, and his wife had passed long before he did, so I was really the closest family he had. I took it all with me to my home in Boston and began to sort through all the papers for important documents, unpublished items that I would be responsible for getting published. In the process, I came upon a strange little box. It was locked. Luckily, I had the professor's personal set of keys on me, and after a few tries, found the right key, managed to get it open. This made things no less unclear, however. Inside were several disjointed notes, newspaper clippings, and an eerie little clay bas-relief.
A clay bas-relief, you said?
Yes. Horrible thing. It was a rough rectangle less than an inch thick. Obviously modern in origin, but wasn't some ancient relic. But The designs, those were anything but modern in both atmosphere and suggestion. Different genres of art, such as cubism, futurism, they have crazy, unpredictable patterns and shapes, but they don't usually create the cryptic repetition of prehistoric writing. This did. These hieroglyphics on the clay, they were writing, all right, but I couldn't define the origin of them or even any similar writing styles, despite all my experience with my uncle's work and language and my own knowledge of the subject. And the image. Oh, God. That terrible visage will haunt me for my nights and days. On the bas-relief, the lack of definition made the exact nature of the figure unclear at the time. It was some sort of monster, or a symbol representing a monster. One that only a diseased mind could conjure up. If I were to say that my excitable imagination yielded simultaneous pictures of an octopus, a dragon, and a human caricature, I wouldn't be far off from the spirit of this beast. A pulpy, tentacled head atop a grotesque and scaly body with underdeveloped wings. But it was just the outline of the thing that made it so frightening to behold. Behind the figure lay a suggestion of a cyclopean architectural background.
A cyclopean city? What is that?
Essentially, cyclopean architecture is very irregular and disjointed in nature. It has irregular blocks that fit together either with clay mortar or no mortar at all, and usually brings to mind instability and inexperienced architects in ancient times. Basically, seeing it implies a very, very old time in which it was...
Hey, sorry to bother you.
I'm in the middle of something. Get one of the servers to get it for you, whatever it is. You were saying.
I looked through the rest of the box and found, aside from a bunch of newspaper clippings, some writing that was in my uncle's hand. No hint of it being some sort of fictional story, and the main document appeared to be one-headed Cthulhu Cult. The letters of the title had been written very carefully, as though the professor had been worried that anyone who may read it would misunderstand such an odd word. This manuscript seemed to be divided into two parts. First half being titled 1925, Dream and Dream Work of H.A. Wilcox, and the second half was titled Narrative of Inspector John R. LaGrasse, Notes on Same and Professor Webb's Account. The other papers in the manuscript were all short notes. Some of them were accounts of weird dreams from different people, and some were citations from theosophical books and magazines. All the rest commented on long-surviving secret societies and hidden cults. References to passages in mythological and anthropological source books, all that stuff. They were mostly related to mental illness and outbreaks of mass hysteria in the spring of 1925. The first half of the manuscript was very strange. It started with a meeting on March 1st, 1925, when an excitable, thin young man showed up at my uncle's office.
So if you could relay to all my students that my new office hours on Thursdays will be from 1 p.m. to...
Pardon me, Professor, but won't that conflict with your seminar next week?
Yes, that's correct. In that case, give me a half hour and I'll call you.
Excuse me, Professor Angel. I really need to speak with you.
Excuse me, young man, but can't you see that I am talking with someone?
I need to speak with you about, this.
I'll come back in a half hour.
Young man, have you no manners? What on earth is this?
That is what I need your help with, Professor. I understand that you have extensive knowledge of Semitic languages and archaeology, and I thought you might be able to help me identify
Look,
this.
I don't know who you are, but this is clearly not archaeological. It's still damp. This couldn't be older than...
About 8 hours. I made it last night.
So why on earth do you need my help with something made within the last day? You made it yourself. You don't need help identifying it.
Yes, I do, actually.
I made it last night while my mind was in a dream of strange cities, and dreams are older than the Sphinx or Babylon or Tyre, so for that, I turn to you. I am so sorry. My excitement overwhelmed me. My name is Henry Anthony Wilcox. I'm an art student at the Rhode Island School of Design. I'm studying sculpture.
Professor Angel had heard the name Wilcox for years, and had seen it in articles and on buildings. And he'd heard of Henry. He was a promising young man, according to anyone who met him, a genius with his artwork, though quite eccentric. From childhood, he had attracted the attention of the community with all of his crazy stories and dreams that he would tell. He referred to himself as psychically hypersensitive, but everyone usually just called him strange.
Wilcox, yes, I remember seeing you around. Your family has done a lot for the community.
I really need your help. I know how it will sound, but please hear me out. Last night, there was this earthquake. While not huge, it was still the most considerable tremor around here in years. It seems that this tremor affected my mind in a way I haven't yet begun to understand. For when I went to sleep, I dreamed of huge cyclopean cities. They were built with massive blocks and sky-high monoliths, and they were all dripping with green ooze and had a sinister sense lingering about the whole area. Hieroglyphics covered all the walls and pillars. And there was this voice, but it wasn't really a voice. It was more like this chaotic sensation that only imagination can form into a voice. And the only way I can attempt to pronounce the sound is Cthulhu Fatagin.
It was this jumble of letters that ignited the professor's interest in the matter. He began to question Wilcox tirelessly, poring over the bas-relief.
Goodness, of course. I apologize. I'm an old man, you see, and sometimes things slip my mind. I can't believe I didn't recognize these symbols before.
The professor asked several odd questions that made no sense to Wilcox, prying for answers that may connect to old cults and secret societies. The young man appeared to have no knowledge of any cryptic cult systems, and the professor ended his peppering of questions.
Mr. Wilcox, I need you to come to me with any and all future reports of weird dreams such as this one.
And so began the series of meetings between Professor Angel and Henry Wilcox. The meeting proved productive, as the young man would come by daily and relate startling dreams of dark imagery and a terrible cyclopean vista with dripping stone and some intelligent shouting and impactful sensory gibberish. The most frequent sounds repeated were Cthulhu and Rillier.
So these words, what do they mean? How can they be so incomprehensible? They seem to just be words in a different language.
Be patient. I'm getting to it. At the next major point in the manuscript, Wilcox didn't show up like he normally would. The day was March 23rd, a few weeks into his regular meetings with the professor, so this was an oddity Angel wasn't prepared for. He discovered after visiting Wilcox's house that the boy had started running a strange sort of fever. Apparently, it had begun with the young man screaming out in the night, and after waking several other artists in the building, had been moved out to be cared for at his family home on Waterman Street. My uncle immediately called the family to check on him and continued to keep a close eye on the case. He called Dr. Toby, the doctor in charge of the case, on a regular basis for updates on the young man's state.
Did you write down anything he said? I asked you to when we spoke before. Did you remember?
Yes, I made a few notes. The young man has repeatedly spoken in fits about a horrible old city dripping with green slime, and a voice, or something like a voice, saying nonsense words. I couldn't make out the gibberish once he started speaking it.
No need. I know what it would have been, most likely. Was there anything new?
The only thing you might think was new was the thing he fears that walks in the dreams now with him.
A thing? What thing?
He never really described it fully. Just that it towered over the city. He used the phrase, miles high. The idea I gathered from it was that it was quite close to the creature you described to me on our first call. This monster that was sculpted by the young man into the piece of clay. Whenever he refers to this beast, he tends to fall back into an unresponsive state shortly after.
How long do you think this could go on for, Doctor? Have you found the physical cause, if there is any?
It's an odd case. His temperature is not far above normal, but because of his condition as a whole, I can think of nothing else it could be besides a fever. I have not found any true physical cause, but I don't believe it to be a mental disorder.
I fear it may be neither, Doctor. Thank you for your time.
On April 2nd, according to the manuscript, Wilcox was suddenly perfectly fine. He woke up, sat up straight in his bed, and had no idea how he'd gotten to his parents' house or what had happened to him since March 22nd, in his mind or in reality. His doctor pronounced him well, and he was back in his own house 3 days later.
I'm sure your uncle was happy about that.
Well, apparently he was no more use to my uncle after that time.
What do you mean? Did he refuse to relate his dreams after all his fits?
No, as a matter of fact. His dreams ended after he came out of his fevered state. The manuscript dictated that all traces of the strange dreams he'd had before disappeared once he awoke from his fever. And after a week of pointless accounts of normal dreams, my uncle ended their sessions. That's where the first part of the manuscript ended.
So it wasn't conclusive in any way?
No. And actually, at this point, I was fully skeptical of there being any truth to Wilcox's dream testimonies. I felt he was just using an old man's obsessive tendencies to mess with him, give him hope. But do you remember the scattered notes I mentioned that I found in the box with the manuscript?
The newspaper clippings?
No. The separate notes that my uncle wrote out that were separate from the manuscript. He referenced several of them in his writing on Wilcox's dream relations and gave me a lot to think about. My curiosity was piqued as they all described other odd occurrences that happened in the same time frame. Other strange dreams being had. Apparently, my uncle had asked several of his friends and people he knew well to report any strange dreams to him and describe them in detail. The more people he had telling him of their dreams, the clearer the demographic of people affected became. Normal people in society, like businessmen, almost completely unaffected. And scientists were only somewhat affected. The demographic of people with the most intense result, and therefore the darkest dreams, was that of artists, poets. You cannot repeat that to anyone. I'm certain that if any information on that got out, there would be a full-on panic among the people in the artistic industry. Promise me this stays with you and goes to no one.
Of course. I promise.
Okay. As I said, I had reason to doubt Wilcox's truthfulness in all of this. As I looked through the notes, I began to get the feeling that whoever led the interviews asked leading questions, so the results may very well have been biased as a result. In any case, according to these notes, even the people who were almost completely unaffected experienced some semblance of unease between February 28th and April 2nd, and any subjects who were having strange dreams experienced intensified horror in them during the period of Wilcox's fever.
Dark, massive stone structure.
Whole green ooze dripping off all the walls.
Something beneath the wall, trying to speak or to scream.
It's terrifying, and they came above the surface.
Enormous, towering above the city, moving through.
I have never
felt fear. That.
And I hope I never will again.
There was one note that told an incredibly sad story. On the day of Wilcox's seizure, a well-known architect went violently insane. A few months later, he died screaming. Screaming to be saved from some escaped resident of hell.
Please, don't let it take me. Please, someone, anyone, keep it away. Stop it. Don't let it. Don't do this.
That's horrible. That poor man.
It was awful. Indeed. I shouldn't tell you anymore. I've told more than I already should.
No. Please. Go on. I can't explain why. But I need to know the rest. It'll stay between us, I swear.
It is better. No one knows all the details, but if you must know... I'll tell you the rest of the story. I hope the artists who were interviewed never hear of any other subject's dreams or of their connection. The newspaper clippings in the box focused on cases of mania, panic, and odd behavior during the time period that the dream interviews occurred.
Were there a lot of stories like that?
The sheer volume of clippings in the box implied that my uncle must have employed helpers to cut all the articles out and collect them. There's no way he could have found and cut out all of those articles on his own. They weren't just from here. They spanned all over the world. The cases, they described absolutely horrific events. Unexpected tragedies and unexplained behavioral anomalies. There was a nighttime suicide in London. A man had screamed out in the night. And then proceeded to leap from a window to his death. A letter to the editor of a paper in South America from a fan predicted a terrifying future from visions he had seen. In California, a theosophist colony all put on white robes for some sort of glorious fulfillment that never came. Items from India spoke of serious unrest among the natives toward the end of March. In Haiti, voodoo orgies multiplied. African outposts report ominous rumors among people. American officers in the Philippines had difficulty keeping the peace among several tribes during the time of the strange dreams. New York policemen were attacked by immigrants on the night of March 22nd to 23rd. In the west of Ireland, wild rumors and tales of horror flew about. A painter hung a blasphemous dream landscape in the spring of 1926.
It's not real.
So many recorded issues and insane asylums occurred during this time that it is truly a miracle that the professionals in the medical field didn't draw wild conclusions. I truly couldn't tell you why I was able to put those cuttings aside so easily.
I can't believe I never heard of any of these events. And that no one is talking about them. Your handling is far better than I would have.
I don't know about that.
No, really. If I'd found anything like that among any of my loved ones' belongings, I wouldn't be able to sleep at night.
I shouldn't continue.
No, I didn't mean I couldn't handle it. I just... Please, continue.
Well, the second part of the manuscript goes into the older matters that had caused my uncle to be interested in the clay bas-relief in the first place. It turns out that my uncle had actually seen the outline of this creature before. And not just that, he had heard the gibberish word Cthulhu and seen the hieroglyphics before, too. 17 years before his meeting with Wilcox, he attended a sort of convention for the American Archaeological Society as an expert for the public, to obtain answers regarding ancient inscriptions and other areas of interest.
Are there any more questions?
The Phaistos disc has on its fired clay surface 242 tokens with 45 recognizable signs. Now, that disc has some resemblance to Cretan hieroglyphics, is that correct, Professor?
The disc mostly shows resemblance to Egyptian and Anatolian inscriptions, not Cretan, as such a laughable suggestion puts forth. But to answer your question...
Smith.
Mr. Smith, no. There's no connection to an outer space language, as you suggested. For that to be true, that language would first have to exist, and aliens would also have to exist.
What about the mystery sludge found with Jorgen Brolin from the Denmark exhibition?
Mystery sludge?
Yes, it was found with his diary. The last page was covered with it.
I'm aware of the story, and yes, it was a terrible thing that happened, but I am curious as to why you are asking me, an authority of ancient inscriptions, about mystery sludge. I'm not a chemist. Is today a slow news day, gentlemen, or have you all been reading too much pulp horror?
I believe that would be the end of this event, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for your time.
It wasn't unusual for Professor Angel to be approached first by civilians with questions, even if they had nothing to do with his field. His intellect and popularity in the archaeological community made him a magnet for any and all questions. He would help when he could, but his whole life changed when he was approached by one man.
Professor Angel.
Hello, sir.
Might I have a word?
I'm afraid that is proving difficult. These conventions only last so long, and I only have so much time to give each person here to see me. But if you make it quick...
I need your help with this.
What is that?
That is exactly what I'm here to find out. My name is Inspector Jean-Raymond Lagrasse. Can we talk?
In the inspector's hands was an ancient, grotesque stone statue. It had a terrible visage and seemed malignant in its demeanor.
I think I can spare a minute for a find such as this. How did you come to possess it?
I'm a police inspector, sir. I found and took this with me when me and my men raided a supposed voodoo meeting in New Orleans a few months ago. The rites of this cult that was connected with this statue were so unique and horrifying that we realized we had come upon something darker than we'd ever thought possible. We've captured a few of the cult members and heard wild tales from them, but nothing we can use to learn anything real about the group. We're now trying to find out any lore we can about this piece, in hopes of tracking down this cult to its fountainhead and ending it for good.
As Lagrasse spoke, other scientists began to gather around and marvel at the statuette, speculating about what it could be. No one present had ever seen anything like it.
What did it look like? The statuette. Was it the same as the outline in the bas-relief?
It was certainly close. The figure was about 7 or 8 inches tall. Beautiful craftsmanship. It represented a monster that had a vaguely humanoid outline, but with an octopus-like head. The face was a mass of feelers, a scaly, rubbery-looking body, enormous claws, and long, narrow wings. It was bloated and in a squatting position and had a horribly malignant feel about it. It squatted on a sort of pedestal that was covered in undecipherable text. The detail, the way it was positioned so specifically, it stays with you. It seemed almost as old as time and yet ageless, and it didn't show any ties to any type of art in our known world. Even its material was a mystery. Soapy, greenish-black stone with golden flecks that resembled nothing we know of in geology or mineralogy. No one present could decipher the text as it was passed around and scrutinized. All those brilliant minds, and no one had an idea. No one. Except for one man.
Who?
Well, all the gathered scientists gave up after a while, and it seemed all hope was lost for the inspector.
Pardon me, gentlemen, but I believe I may be able to help with this. My name is William Channing Webb. I'm a professor of anthropology at Princeton. I'm also a bit of an explorer. Well, maybe more than a bit.
You recognize this?
I've seen something quite similar. Almost 50 years ago, I was traveling through Greenland and Iceland in search for some inscriptions that were said to be buried in a specific area. Unfortunately, something else became the focus of my trip, and I was unable to recover these runes instead. I encountered an Eskimo tribe whose religions chilled me to my core. He was some form of devil worship, some deliberate bloodthirstiness, horrible stuff. I asked the other Eskimos that I met later if they knew of these people, and they didn't have much information to share. They would just shudder when they spoke of that faith and said that it was old, older than the earth itself. Along with human sacrifice and unknowable rites, the members of this dark tribe would perform odd rituals that were addressed to some supreme elder devil or Tornasuk. I took down a very careful phonetic copy of the words spoken by the wizard priest, or Angekok, doing my best to form the sounds he made into real letters. But the reason I know this is the same is the figure at the center of these people's worship. They danced around a crude stone bas-relief when the auras danced in the sky. The stone including not only a hideous picture, but also some cryptic writing. As far as I can tell, it consisted of all the defining features of the thing I see in your hand, Inspector.
This new information excited LeGrasse, and he immediately began questioning Webb. He had copied down the oral ritual that the swamp cult worshippers had chanted, and he pushed the professor hard to remember what these syllables were that he had taken down from the priest. A truly exhausting comparison of details followed, and when the inspector and the professor finally pinned down the phrase, an awed silence fell over the crowd around them. These men had found a connection between two different cults in two different parts of the world, and when they spoke the words, everyone felt a chill.
Feng Lui, Ming Lua Nafa, Cthulhu Rilye, Wiganangal, Fatagin.
Well, what was the phrase? What does it mean?
Well, LeGrasse actually knew that. Apparently, several of his prisoners had told him what older cult members had told them of its meaning, which was, in his house at Rilye, dead Cthulhu waits dreaming.
What does that mean? Who is Cthulhu?
The surrounding scientists began to insist that LeGrasse tell of his time with the swamp worshippers, and so he told his story.
All right. It's not confidential, so... A few months ago, we got called to the swamp country in southern Orleans. A lot of homeless people lived down there. Good-natured people who have just had a rough go of it. But they were terrified. Something had come into their turf during the night. Voodoo, it was suspected. But this was no ordinary voodoo. It was dark and terrible. A kind we had never known. Apparently, some of the women and children living among the vagrants had disappeared since this cult had moved in. There was a tom-tom beat deep in the woods where none of the squatters dared to venture. The same shouts and screams, chilling chants and hellish flames dancing. The people couldn't stand it anymore. So that's when we got the call.
It was late afternoon when 20 police officers set out towards the swamp with one of the squatters as their guide.
Once we get to the end of the road, we have to walk to get to the spot. It won't be a very nice walk, I'm afraid.
As long as at the end of it we find what we're looking for, I'll walk as long as necessary.
They reached the end of the road and started their walk, squelching through miles of dark woods and marshy ground in silence.
There were gnarled roots and creeping Spanish moss all around the men, with hints here and there of the living spaces of long-gone vagrants. Eventually, they found the settlement of the current homeless inhabitants.
We're here, everyone. I brought them.
Already, LeGrasse and his men could hear the beat of tom-toms in the distance as the people swirled around them, and a horrifying shriek pierced the night at irregular intervals. They could see a reddish glare coming through the trees from the direction of the canopy.
They shouldn't be too hard to find with all that racket. Will you lead us to their camp?
No, sir. Please, don't you make me go, please. We never go in close. Especially with so many of us going missing since they arrived. We're terrified of it. I'm sorry if you expected me to, but I can't go.
It's okay, calm down. As I said, they're not exactly hiding, so without your help, we should manage just fine.
Thank you, sir.
With that, LeGrasse and his 19 men plunged into the dark with no guide, carving their way through the wood towards the dark symphony of madness. The men knew of a hidden lake in these woods that had a terrifying history. And while the voodoo ceremony was on the very fringe of that area, just the location alone might have been enough to scare the vagrants stiff.
All right, men. We're getting in close. We don't want to barge in right away and announce our presence before we know what we're up against. Stealth from here on in, till I give the signal. Got it?
Yes, sir.
He and his men had reached a suddenly thin area of trees and could see everything. The whole spectacle in all its terrible glory. There was a dry, grassy island before them, and on it danced an indescribable horde of people. All were naked, screeching and bellowing around a ring-shaped bonfire.
Hold your positions. Wait for my signal.
LeGrasse could see something in the center of the fire on a granite monolith around 8 feet high. The statuette? Tin scaffolds hung in a circle around the center, and from them...
Sir, are those...
bodies. The bodies of our missing vagrants.
Bodies? Hanging from the scaffolds? Those poor people. And LeGrasse's men, how did they cope with seeing that?
They didn't handle it great. One fainted, two screamed, as anyone would have at that horrific of a sight. One of his men claimed he heard strange responses to the ritual from the deep woods. I actually held a meeting with this man and questioned him on this event. He was a very imaginative man. He said, along with the horrible responses he heard, the beating of the massive wings, he saw a glimpse of shining eyes and massive white shapes far beyond the trees.
It was probably just an echo, or maybe just his imagination running away with him.
Yes. I'm sure that it was.
All together, men! Duty comes first! You brought your weapons, use them!
There must have been over 100 people dancing around the flames that night, but LeGrasse's men plunged into the fray, guns blazing. It was absolute mayhem. Though many escaped by the end of it, LeGrasse counted 47 prisoners.
Find your clothes and put them on. You have 20 seconds, go.
As one of his men counted down and the rest wrangled the prisoners, the inspector snuck to the monolith and plucked the horrible statuette from its place of honor.
Now, what are you?
Sir, we've counted 5 dead and 2 severely injured. The rest are dressed and in line with the rest of our team, sir.
Yes. Good. We'll head back immediately. Make sure the prisoners are secure all the way back to the vehicles.
Yes, sir.
Once his crew got the prisoners back to the headquarters, a quick examination told LeGrasse that all his captives were very low class, mostly sailors. He decided to interrogate one of the women, a young woman no older than 26.
You just come in here to enjoy the view.
I have some questions for you if you have the time.
I've got all the time in the world, sweetie.
Watch it. I found something at your site. I have some questions about it.
Well, what'd you find?
Your idol on the monolith. Took it with me as a souvenir.
How dare you take what's not yours? You and Kadaratha, the great old ones. You will rot forever in...
So that's the name. Great old one? Well, sweetie, you're not going anywhere anytime soon, so unless you'd like to go back to talking to a cement wall, I'd suggest you take this opportunity to talk to a living person about your passions. So, what is this great old one?
Once. Multiple.
Okay.
They came before the age of men, right out of the sky. They're gone now. Inside the earth, right beneath your feet and under the sea. But the first men, they dreamed of them and learned their secrets, and their cult has never died. It has always existed and will always exist. We will thrive in dark places and hidden wastelands all over the world.
So if I may ask, what exactly is the point of your group? What sits at the center of your faith? What comes next?
One day, the great priest Cthulhu will come up from his home under the ocean's waves and will bring the world under his influence once again. And it's our job to stay as his disciples. For once he is ready and the stars are in his favor, he will call us to liberate him from the ocean's grasp. And that's all.
That's all?
Yes, sir. I'd like to be alone now.
I'll be back.
LeGrasse continued to question the rest of the prisoners, but didn't learn much new information. He tortured a few of the men for more, but there seemed to be a point where every cult member clammed up. Some secret they weren't willing to reveal under any physical torment. All he truly gathered was the meaning of the chant.
In this house of Rille, dead Cthulhu waits dreaming.
Only 2 of the prisoners proved sane enough to be put to death. The rest were admitted to mental institutions. No one admitted to the murders of the vagrants. They all claimed that the killing had been done by the black winged ones that came out of the haunted woods. The main source of information ended up being a very old cult member by the name of Castro. He claimed to have sailed to strange ports and talked with immortal leaders of the cults in the mountains of China. As he spoke of ancient legends, it made the age of man and the world we know now to be young and recent.
There have been eons when things ruled the earth with their towering cities. The immortal man told me that remains of them could still be found as cyclopean stones in the Pacific Islands.
If these things were so fantastic, what happened to them? Why aren't they still here?
Oh, they all died ages and ages before the dawn of man. However, there are arts and rituals that can revive them when the time is right. When the stars come round again in their eternal cycle. After all, they themselves came from the stars and brought their images with them.
Sorry, they came from the stars?
Well, you see, the great old ones were not made entirely of flesh and blood. They had no shape, of course. If nothing else proves that, this star-made idol you rescued does. But their shape is not made of matter. When the stars are right, the way the old ones could travel. They could plunge from world to world through the sky, but when the stars are wrong, they cannot live at all.
You're saying these creatures are dead, and you still worship them as these great beings?
They will never really die. In their great city of Rilye, they lay in their stone houses, forever preserved by the spells of Cthulhu. And they will rise again when the stars and earth are ready for them again. But that's our job. To be there as the outer force to liberate their bodies.
Why? Why can't they do it themselves?
These spells, they preserve them, kept them intact. But they also prevent them from making the first move. So they can only lie awake in the dark and think while millennia upon millennia go by. But they are not ignorant. They know all that happens in our world and in all other worlds. And they can communicate, but only through transmitted thought. The first men discovered this when the great old ones molded their dreams so their language could be understood by us.
Uh-huh. So where does this idol come in?
The old ones showed them the idols. They led them to their hiding places. And the men formed a never-ending cult around these statuettes. It will never end. Not until the secret priest wakes Cthulhu when the stars are right, and he wakes his brethren and again rule the earth.
And do you have any idea when this will happen? Any sort of timeline?
We will know. For we will have become like the great old ones. There will be no law, no morals, no good, and no evil. We will dance and shout and revel and kill and be free with no remorse to hold us back. We will learn from the original old ones once they wake how to be free like they do. And the earth will blaze with ecstasy and freedom. But until then, we have to keep the memories of these ways alive among ourselves. The first men knew this. Chosen ones of them would speak with the great old ones in dreams, but something happened. Rilye had sunk beneath the waves, but the memory never died. Even though direct communication became difficult and impossible. And out of the earth came these black spirits. I'm done now. Sorry to have taken so much of your time.
What black spirits?
No, I misspoke, that's all.
So as far as where this all began, or where the center is now,
I've heard rumors the epicenter lies somewhere in the deserts of Arabia, but I can't be certain. I can't tell you about the history of it, however. It's kept secret from all but the highest priests of the cult, of which I am not.
The only other thing he let be known to Legras was that the immortal man he met had hinted at double meanings in the Necronomicon. Specifically, the couplet. That is not dead, which can eternal lie, and with strange eons, even death may die.
In the end,
LeGrasse didn't get the information he needed on the history of the cult. Not from the prisoners he took, nor the archaeologists at the convention. So that killed his chances of hunting down the Fountainhead and ending this cult for good.
How could he continue to focus on that when these ideas have been brought up?
That's exactly what the archaeologists at the convention thought. They were fascinated by the whole thing, that much is clear, just by looking at any of their notes from the event.
How do you know the statuette was in fact the same creature from the bas-relief? It could have been just another strange monster.
I saw it myself. No mistaking it.
You saw it? How?
After reading all of this, I assumed that Wilcox had somehow heard about this event and decided to take advantage of my uncle's interest.
Call of Cthulhu is a Mad Artists Entertainment production. The script is adapted from H.P. Lovecraft's The Call of Cthulhu by Danielle Lorenz. This episode was directed by Danielle Lorenz with sound editing and production by Brett Leverett. Call of Cthulhu stars Thomas Cox, John Legalis, Caleb Perry, Rick Harper, and Adam Farmer, with additional ensemble voices credited in the channel description. For more information regarding Mad Artists Entertainment and to contact us, please visit our website at madartistco.com.